Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And I'm going to spend a lot of time on this, but it feels like it should be remarked upon. I was at the Bears game yesterday.
Oh, that's right, because you said you wanted to go to the Saints game.
That was an ass-kicking on both sides of the ball. Basically, let's hope the...
I noticed how everybody left in the fourth quarter.
I remember that song being played once when Cordell Patterson returned the ball 102 yards off a kickoff, and then half-heartedly being played when Pinero made a field goal. But that was about all the scoring before slop time. That was domination. That Bears team,
they're flat, man.
Is a wreck.
Yeah, they need a new quarterback.
Well, they need
something. They need somebody to lead. They need a leader out there, and they obviously don't have that.
They're running a West Coast offense that neither moves the ball nor scores, which is a different version of the West Coast offense than I remember from sort of the glory days of Montana. There's no offensive line. Before slop time, it's the 17 yards rushing. Akeem Hicks,
yeah.
Do they miss him that much? Where was Eddie Goldman? Where was Khalil Mack? They got run over. They made Teddy Bridgewater look like Drew Brees. There's a 100-yard rusher, a 100-yard receiver. I mean, this is the same Teddy Bridgewater that used to play for the Vikings. It's not like they haven't seen this guy before. Remarkable. Hub Arkush, would you like to revise and extend your remarks? I'm at a golf outing over the summer. Hub Arkush is the MC.
Yeah.
And he talks about the Bears' forthcoming season because he's one of these experts. It seems like the experts in a lot of sports media are very much like the experts in political media, which is to say not experts. He says, look, I don't know. They may be a year away, but I could see them challenging the Saints for the NFC Championship this year. That's what Hub Arkush said. Could you see them challenging the Saints now? And then that's after getting run over by Oakland across the pond. That's 2 weeks in a row, two games in a row, actually, off a bye week. That performance was off
that's
a bye week. I was flabbergasted watching it. This vaunted offense. I mean, excuse me, the vaunted defense. I knew the offense was going to be a struggle. Mitch Trubisky, don't screw up, don't turn the ball over. There were a couple of turnovers yesterday, not on him. Remarkable.
But they had no answers. I mean, Matt Nagy, Mitch Trubisky, they
got outscored.
He just said, we have no identity. We're just searching.
They got outscored 24-0 at home in the second half before it was, let's just play flag football for a few minutes to run the clock.
Right.
24-0 at home in the second half. It was 12-10 at half. They were lucky to be there.
But the Saints had fire in their belly. Like, they came to play.
Obviously,
the Bears were just sleeping. They were in London the first half.
The first series, block a punt.
I know.
Block a punt? What?
A safety, too. Yeah.
So,
but I like how everybody left then. I mean, you were there. Did you leave early or did you see?
No. I mean, not 36-10 and then, with the 5 minutes left, then it was time to, head to the exits. But
that's when the game got exciting.
But this team is not a year away, maybe challenging this year? No. Oh, no. Wow. And that was after I endured Friday night. I mean, these are the trials and travails of my life.
Yeah, what did you have to endure Friday night?
Well, I went to the Northwestern Ohio State game to see Northwestern get beat 52-3.
At least they scored a field goal.
Whew. That's a terrible team. The Northwestern faithful, all those North Shore denizens that I saw in the stands, Should we hold off on erecting the Pat Fitzgerald statue outside of Ryan Field? Should we hold off on that? That is a bad football team, too.
They play Iowa this weekend at Northwestern. We'll see what happens.
Yeah, that'll be scintillating. That'll be, you know, 9-3.
You're listening to Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. What did you do to advance the cause of menstrual equity this weekend? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I assume you were at a National Period Day rally, Amy.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know what? I didn't get the memo about this. What menstrual equity week or rally, or is it a month? Or is there a certain color we have to wear?
Hey-o! You.
Do we have to wear red ribbons?
It's vivid. Thank you.
You're welcome.
National Period Day rallies in D.C. Okay. And 59 other rallies across the nation on Saturday advocating for widespread period product access and an end to the tampon tax, of course. Rallygoers also demanded Congress address reports of migrant women in detention centers denied period products and bleeding through their clothing.
Did you see the picture of National Period Day? There's women
holding
up fists with tampons in their hands and strings coming out of their hands. That is disgusting. Keep it private, ladies. I mean, really.
A 21-year-old from Brownsville, Texas.
Is this her menstruation story, Dan?
It is.
We need special music behind this.
Okay. Well, I'll let you choose from the catalog. It was really tough. I remember the shame we felt. No one should ever have to feel that way. It's time to end menstrual inequity. She's recalling, yes. Julie Sanchez is her name. Growing up, she would stay home from school when she got her.
Oh, suck it up.
Period.
I mean, honestly. Well, if we all did that, there's no work would be done if everybody just crawled in a corner.
Keynote speaker Julie Schweitert-Colazzo, director of Immigrant Families Together. Oh, they do very good work. Less often do we talk about menstrual equity in places that are totally beyond public view, such as prisons, immigration, detention centers. They cannot be here to speak in their own words today. So Julie was asking that we do not forget them today on National Period Day, and I want you to know I haven't. Nadia Okamoto is a 21-year-old junior at Harvard University. She's the co-founder of the nonprofit advocacy group Period.
I see what they did there.
She helped launch the series of rallies across the country because period poverty disproportionately affects people in low-income households.
Well, according to their website, they said it's found that 46% of low-income women have to choose between eating a meal or paying for food and a period product. 46% of low-income women.
I bring you this story and those fictional statistics for the purpose of reminding you that there is no depth to which the identitarians won't sink. There is no depth to which they will not sink. There is no bottom to the lunacy. Zero. So you better.
I can see how people, homeless women might have problems, but at these shelters and food banks, they do hand out feminine products. And I only know because I worked at one for 2 years.
So it's not a national crisis then?
No, there's help available for them.
Hmm. That brings me to a related story. PScouts.com.
What?
PScouts.
P?
As in P hats.
Oh.
But they spell it out. PScouts.com is produced by FCKH8.com. I'll let you sound that out at home. It's a T-shirt company on a mission to inspire social change. The company has raised $250,000 for equity causes, perhaps menstrual equity, arming thousands of people with pro-LGBT equality, anti-racism, and anti-sexism T-shirts that act as mini billboards for progress. And they have little girls in this video you're about to hear wearing something approximating a Girl Scout uniform with merit badges. And they're saying things like this.
Oh, Scouts! Ready for your song about President Trump?
Yay! Yay! Granny be dropping a beat that's sick. We gotta rap about a president.
You call women fat pigs? Show no respect. rapist, sex, assault culprit.
And take away a woman's abortion right.
That makes Liz Warren.
I'll take it down in a fight.
Like Princess Leia choked out Jabba the Hutt.
The women's march showed, women's mount can't be shut.
Super callous.
Fox for racist, sexist, not my opponent.
Yeah, racist Muslim band.
You're the Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan.
And immigrants that you hate and berate. It's racist ignorance. Don't make America great.
Bitches, and we dropped the mic.
Scouts.com. The hat emerged in the Women's March as a powerful symbol of the fight for equality. Get your hat or get involved with the cause and get a shirt. Girls just want to have fun, demental rights. This is what a feminist looks like. Scouts.com.
And again, for emphasis,
ew,
like
disgusting
grammar school girls featured in this, profanity, references to body parts,
profanity laced toward or directed toward President Trump. Too.
Correct. PeaceScouts.com is patronized by big time celebrities. Jane Lynch, Adam Lambert, Zac Efron raved about his Some Dudes Marry Dudes Get Over It t-shirt. Zach, you're so current and courageous. Whoopi Goldberg, Rachel Ray, both support this Potty Mouth Princesses campaign. That's what it's called, Potty Mouth Princesses. Okay. John and Lombard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, guys. Good morning. Can't these women just identify as a man a couple days a month and not have this problem anymore?
Well, I think, John, thanks for the call and the suggestion. I'm glad the wheels are turning. But I think... in order to advance the cause of equity, you'd have to have men.
Women identify as men for a few days to avoid.
We need men to identify as women
because men, there's
to be simpatico.
Well, there's such a thing called menstruation.
You don't have to tell me.
And I just don't know how you come up with money to pay for the taxed items that you have to purchase.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to tackle menstruation equity on another show.
Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, Mary Laurie the Lightfoot continuing to up her ante to try to settle the Chicago teacher strike. And at the same time, proposing all sorts of new tax increases. Isn't that interesting? Huh.
Yeah, isn't she going to go to Springfield to ask for money? And if she can't get it, then she's going to raise our property taxes, guys. Isn't that great?
So she's going to do this. She's going to say, basically, look, per my slogan, better together. It's better if we ruling class politicians raise taxes together. Otherwise, you're going to force me to do it by myself, and then I'll just blame you. Is that what she said when she ran for office?
No.
I'm going to make the tough decisions by going to Springfield with my tin cup like every other mayor has ever done and demanding more of the state's money to prop up this House of Cards in Chicago, because that's what... paradigm shifting leadership looks like? No, not really. Not really. So here we go. We've got proposals to increase the taxes on ride sharing services, yeah. Make them the most expensive in the nation.
It's a $3 tax on a solo ride share trip to downtown. So if I was going out to the suburbs, they wouldn't put it on me. But if you're going downtown, that's where they're going to stick it to you for Lyft and Uber.
60 cents per trip to 113 for single riders. Single ride trips going or leaving from downtown during peak hours, that would be an additional 175. That's a tripling. Also, Lori Lightfoot announced that she wants everybody dining out to chip in. Oh, she's asking.
For what?
To chip in an additional 25 cents for every $100 restaurant tab. Doubling the city's tax on food and drinks at restaurants.
What?
Isn't that sort of one of the last golden geese in Chicago? Is the bar and restaurant business going to put a crimp in that? These and other responsible solutions will help the city secure dedicated revenues, preparing for long-term blah, 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 blah. And then, of course, the big one, as you mentioned, if I don't get some bailout money from Springfield, then everybody's property taxes are going up. Well, let me tell you something.
They're broke.
What do you think is going to happen to your property taxes when this deal is struck to end the teacher strike with the blank check they're already writing that they can't finance? They have no way to finance what they've proposed giving the teachers. Mm-hmm. The raises against the backdrop of doing nothing on pensions and health care benefits, which are benefit levels they cannot currently finance. I'll tell you what, it's a funny thing. It turns out that these budget deficits and unfunded liabilities are very homophobic and racist. And maybe that's the way we need to couch it. We need to couch budget deficits and unfunded liabilities, debt, public debt, as racist and homophobic. Maybe that would get some people's attention to put them out of business, because those budgets and those unfunded liabilities and that public debt, that's racist and homophobic. We have the triple threat as mayor. We have a black, female, gay mayor. I thought all these problems were going to go away. What's happening? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'll tell you what's happening is people are going away.
Oh, yeah. There's a woman I met yesterday at church, lives in Logan Square. Her property taxes, Dan, or I'm sorry, Lincoln Square, went from $16,000 a year to $24,000 a year. Mine went up about $2,000. But that's $2,000 that I don't want to give to the city, so now I'm looking to move. Because I'm
not... Where are you going?
I don't know. I looked at an apartment or condo down the street. Their property taxes for this tiny little...
Condo?
A condo down my street. Ready? Wow. Are you ready? Property taxes for this little... It's as big as this room. $8,400. Like, well, why would I move from my place to live here?
Well, why? Yeah, why would you?
There's not that much of a difference. Well, I'm not. I went in there thinking, okay, this will be... I'm sure the property taxes are lower, and I got in there, and it's $8,400.
Can I just say again, there is no sense in buying property in this state.
No, none whatsoever.
You cannot make a return, so why would you encumber yourself with a long-term asset that is immediately depreciating faster than your car does when you drive it off the lot, while you're paying these confiscatory property taxes? And because you're paying these confiscatory property taxes, in addition, people don't want to live here. We just talked last week about the crickets market. This is according to real estate brokerages in the city. Crickets market, worse than the Great Recession of 2008, according to one Northside broker.
Right, because you can only claim $10,000 in Illinois
that's
property taxes.
Small part of it. We had a problem before that. That's really the same.
You can't even write it off.
That's the same situation in every other state in the nation. And it's Chicago that Realtor.com projected to have the worst housing market of the top 200 metro areas in 2019. And that prediction is proving true.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Greg from Jefferson Park and I are on the same wavelength. He's about to set me up for our latest notorious exiter. Greg in Jefferson
Park. Good morning, Dan, Amy. Hope you guys had a good weekend.
Yes. National Period Day, we both celebrated.
So gross.
Hey, I don't know if you caught it, but Dennis Byrne had a perspective in yesterday's Tribune, and everyone listening to this needs to go get it on the website, whatever, photocopy it, make 100 copies, and give it to everyone you know. It explains in detail... a guy who has lived in Chicago and had his career in Chicago, his whole life is moving to Florida. You know, in addition to that, I got a couple friends who live in Park Ridge, and they are getting slammed
with
property tax increases, man.
Oh, yeah.
It's just getting hit huge.
Thanks for the call, Greg. So here, so long, Illinois. Goodbye, Chicago, writes Dennis Byrne. Here, I was born and raised, schooled and worked. Practically my entire life has unfolded in Chicago and close by. As a kid, I rode on Chicago streetcars and the wooden L cars before there was a CTA. Took the old North Shore line to high school and college. Flew out of Midway Airport when it was the nation's busiest and before there was O'Hare. Caddied in Northfield wonder where he caddies. Northfield.
What place is it? What course is in Northfield? Standby.
Sunset Ridge is Glenview. I got to find out where Dennis Byrne caddies. All right. Anyway, I digress. Labored over a North Avenue Knitting Mills steam table. Worked for 3 Chicago daily newspapers. I love Chicago. Chicago is my town, but I've had enough. Fed up. I'm gone.
Northfield Golf Club, Legacy Golf, or Wollinger's Golf? No. Any sound familiar?
No.
Okay. Do continue.
He goes on to write, there are many reasons for leaving, as there are people fleeing, the weather not being the least of them, but little is being done about Chicago's weather. Little is to be done about Chicago's weather, unlike how the city and state have been ravaged by the greedy, incompetent, and power-hungry, by the boodlers, gonfs, and crooks who fancy themselves as the feudal lords and we their vassals, by public employee unions, Chicago Teachers Union, that have turned the idea of public service into a joke on the taxpayers, who in fact have become the public servants, by voters whose party loyalties, ideologies, and self-serving have made Chicago not just a national laughingstock, but a dangerous place. Dennis Byrne. He gone. Where else have teachers walked out on their students after rejecting an unaffordable $2.5 billion contract package that offered, among other things, a 16% pay raise? And with other built-in increases, would raise the average teacher's salary over 5 years to nearly 100 grand. I don't need a statistical analysis to know that thousands are fleeing the carnage, but the politicians and others who've run the city and state into the ground seem oblivious to the facts that residents are getting the hell out. They're not oblivious. This is a mistake even the great Dennis Byrne makes. They're not oblivious. Stop pretending they just have their heads in the clouds. They don't care. They do not care. Because here's the counterintuitive reality. The worse they make it, the better it gets for them, the socialists. And, you know, the handful of Republicans bouncing around out on the hustings running into each other. The worse it gets, the worse they make it, the better it gets for them. Because as you have productive people flee who can do grade school math, who's left? The beneficiaries of the kleptocracy. Those at the top end, public sector unions. Those at the bottom end, state and city dependents who have had their souls crushed through the welfare state, basically, and are the beneficiaries of transfer payments. And so you have champagne socialists, public sector unions at the top, beneficiaries of transfer payments at the bottom, nothing in between. So that constituency is San Francisco. And what do they send to Congress? What is their local leadership like? You see? So this is all good news for the socialists. They are not oblivious. They do not care. They are happy to tear asunder your life. They're happy to take your property. They're happy to force your company to another state. Because, frankly, you're the problem. If you properly understand that their outlook is just solely about political power, as Dennis Byrne references, then you start to bring into focus what they're actually doing and why they're doing it. Lori Lightfoot asking people to chip in this and chip in that. Yeah. Sure.
Yeah, sure. Take more of my money. And please. No, really.
And you'll have the corporate titans in Chicago go along with it. And you'll have even those who are hurt by the policies that she advances. Regressive taxes. Right? Regressive taxes that disproportionately hurt people on the lower end. That's what regressive means. Who are the people on the lower end? Disproportionately minorities in black neighborhoods on the south and west sides, and some Latino neighborhoods as well. And you'll have the frat and sorority graduates, you know, still populate River North, and you'll have some empty nesters come down and get a place in the Gold Coast or in Streeterville or in Old Town or in Lincoln Park. And it'll all be hunky-dory. I'm not really vested in Chicago. I can leave any time. Don't care. Don't want to get involved. So let the barbarians run the city. Oh, and they will. They are. That's what Dennis Byrne is getting to.
Yeah, it's a great article.
Verlon on the South Side.
Well, Dan, you said it last week. They were going to make a big whoop, and then she was going to slowly concede to every issue. She's conceded to the teachers making $100,000 a year. They're going to do a massive hiring of nurses and social workers. And alongside that, they're going to use our homes as ATMs. And what gives them the right to ask for affordable housing for
the homeless, and I guess
for themselves as well, because they say they don't make enough. Listen, they're getting all their perks now, and guess what the kicker is going to be? In 3 years, before her next election, they're going to get them again. This city's done.
Thanks, Verlon.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Programming note, bottom of the 6 o'clock hour, we're going to talk to our friend Joseph O'Call. Remember him? Joseph O'Call is a math teacher and chess coach at Earl STEM Academy.
That's right.
Joseph O'Call.
Is he crossing the picket line?
He has.
I know. And is he still continuing to do so? Wow.
Michael in Lake Forest, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Six little words. Yeah. Rome wasn't bilked in a day.
Okay.
Well,
thanks,
apparently,
thanks for the call, Michael.
They did make some progress in reference to school counselors, because that's what teachers have wanted. They say, I can't be a teacher and a counselor and, you know, a school nurse all in one. I need help. And that some progress was made last night.
I am a professional school counselor in Chicago Public Schools, and I am so relieved tonight to announce a historic shift in Chicago Public Schools' use of their counselors. Yeah.
Okay, but what exactly? She wouldn't have a definite number of how many more school counselors are going to give? Unless for some reason you might possibly have that information, because it's all ambiguity.
Yeah, I got this from the Democrat Socialists of America out there supporting the teachers. I mean, how can you distinguish between the two groups, frankly? The Maduroistas out there, shameful people who went down to Venezuela, and this can't be said enough, to support the repressive Maduro regime. It's one thing to, you know, tweet about China like some of these NBAers. It's another thing to go down to Venezuela and be used as propaganda tools for a dictator like Maduro. That's what they did, and nary a crossword was said from anybody in the teachers union, Chicago teachers cohort that I heard. The class size red herring. Our Janice Jackson, Ms. Jackson, if you're nasty, the superintendent there, said our class size would allocate $10 million to support additional staffing for the relatively small number of overcrowded classrooms in the district. Oh, there's a statement. This is the big issue. Overcrowded classrooms. Here's $10 million in a $7 billion enterprise. That's CPS. Here's $10 million. We'll throw it overcrowding for the handful of schools that are over, a handful of classrooms that are overcrowded. What a joke. And that school counselor that you just heard from is a joke.
Well, also, city soccer playoffs were supposed to start today. And students, you know, I know you might not care about soccer.
No, this is great news.
No, this is a student, Osvaldo Barragan, who was hoping to get a scholarship.
I was also supposed to have some college coaches come look at me on Wednesday. But, like, then again, like, I don't know if that's going to happen. And this is something that can impact the rest of my life.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to have two games on Saturday. Those got canceled. We're not going to make those back up.
If the strike leads to less soccer being played, then that's the silver lining for me.
Oh, my God.
Tony and Roselle.
You know, I spoke with a teacher friend over the weekend. And besides the class sizes and the counselors that they're asking for, she said that there's no way a student in her class, it's virtually impossible for that child to get this disciplined and suspended. So if you've got these kids that are acting up and doing all these crazy things in school like kids do, there's no discipline for them. She's like, I wish we had school resource officers or counselors so I can get these idiots out of here so I can teach the rest of the kids. But apparently discipline's gone out the window.
That's right. Thanks for the call, Tony. That's right. Patrick in North Chicago.
Yeah, Dan, I'd just like to make a comment. The Catholic Church condemns socialism over 100 years ago for three reasons. One, it robs people who've accumulated wealth. Two, it robs hope from people who want to accumulate wealth. And three, it talks about the government's overreaching impact on our lives. That's too much.
And it makes government God, doesn't it? Thanks for the call, Patrick. And the church doesn't want God supplanted by the government. They're right on that.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, have you changed your position as it pertains to Trump's impeachment, which is probably forthcoming before the year's out? Have you changed your position based on the Mick Mulvaney excited utterance last week? Mick Mulvaney is chief of staff.
Temporary chief of staff. I mean, well, I think he's going to be replaced soon, but.
His chief of staff saying that in questioning back and forth at this briefing he had about his knowledge of the interplay between President Trump and President Zelensky of Ukraine over aid, was perceived to have suggested that there was a quid pro quo based on assisting effectively with the look back at the 2016 election and Ukrainian meddling. What the left calls digging up dirt on your opponents, what the transcript suggests is cooperating with the DOJ investigation into the 2016 election. Very different things. It's being purposely, of course, mischaracterized by the press corps. But here's Mulvaney and Wallace, this exchange, and Mulvaney essentially restating what we discussed on Friday about the variables that informed the delay in the transference of aid to Ukraine that ultimately and importantly was transferred.
Why? Here's my first question. Why did you say in that briefing that President Trump had ordered a quid pro quo that investigating the Democrats, that aid to Ukraine depended on investigating the Democrats? Why'd you say that?
Again, that's not what I said. That's what people said that I said. Here's what I said. I'll say it again, and hopefully people will listen this time. There were two reasons that we held up the aid. We've talked about this at some length. The first one was the rampant corruption in Ukraine. Ukraine, by the way, Chris, is so bad in Ukraine that in 2014, Congress passed a law requiring us to make sure that corruption was moving in the right direction. So corruption's a big deal. Everybody knows it. The president was also concerned about whether or not other nations, specifically European nations, were helping with foreign aid to the Ukraine as well. We've talked about that for quite a while now. I did then mention that in the past, the president had mentioned for me to time to time about the DNC server. He'd mentioned the DNC server to other people publicly. He even mentioned it to President Zelensky in the phone call, but it wasn't connected to the aid. And that's where I think people got sidetracked this weekend at that press conference.
Yeah, so that's his explanation. Then he and Wallace go back and forth. He said two factors, but there you mentioned three at your briefing, the third being the cooperation with the DOJ investigation and the story that, cooperating with the DOJ investigation. That's news to us, said some DOJ official. Well, of course it would be news to you. You don't have to necessarily communicate to the DOJ what you've communicated to President Zelensky. You're not supposed to be directing the DOJ investigation that is independent of even DOJ tapping U.S. Attorney John Durham to ride point on it. So if he was sort of setting up people and heads of state to talk to DOJ, then people would say, you're meddling with this DOJ investigation. You're directing the DOJ investigation, Mr. President. So, again, you're sort of damned if you do, damned if you don't with these guys. But on the quid pro quo, quid pro no.
Once we were able to satisfy ourselves that corruption was actually, they were doing better with it. We got that information from our folks, from the conversation with Mr. Zelensky. And once we were able to establish, we had the Office of Management Budget do research on other countries' aid to Ukraine. It turns out they don't give hardly any lethal aid, but they do give a considerable sum of money in non-lethal aid. Once those two things were cleared, the money flowed. There was never any connection between the flow of money and the
service. But, Mick.
Right. It is sort of an important point in these bear repeating in the face of the mantra of the left and their D.C. press corps handmaidens. The money flowed.
Right.
Zelensky was unaware that the aid had been delayed. So, and there was, and the money flowed without anything in return. So, how could there be a quid pro quo if only one side is trying to effect a quid pro quo? If specific performance was made by one side without specific performance to consummate the quid pro quo on the other side? Mulvaney also addressed the John Bolton comment. John Bolton, per Fiona Hill's testimony, Fiona Hill worked for Bolton at NSA. John Bolton's alleged comment that he didn't want any part of the drug deal, quote unquote, metaphorical drug deal, that Mulvaney and Giuliani were cooking up with respect to Ukraine. Mulvaney addressed that.
Because I read that and I was surprised because John Bolton never complained to me about it. No one at NSC ever complained to me about anything that was going on. I didn't see Sondland's testimony this week because none of us have seen Sondland's testimony, which is another story entirely. I did get a chance to read his opening statement when he said that Bolton never complained to him. Fiona Hill never got a chance to complain to him. I think you need to put sort of the...
Wait a minute. Fiona Hill is the one who testified. That's the quote came from her.
Never complained to Sondland about what was happening when it was happening.
No, she complained to her boss, John Bolton.
Who did what?
Who said, who told her to go immediately to a lawyer
right
at the NSC and to complain about it.
Who works for John Bolton? Yet John Bolton didn't go say anything to anybody. Doesn't that raise a red flag with it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, again, if that's that quote from Fiona Hill attributed to John Bolton is correct, then if John Bolton was so concerned, why didn't he raise this issue with Mulvaney, with the President of the United States? He's the National Security Advisor. I mean, this is so much to do about nothing. Andy Biggs.
He shouldn't have gone on Fox News. I don't think Mick Mulvaney should have. He should have just let it go. Because they're going to keep asking about the quid pro quo.
Well, they're going to keep asking about it and prosecuting this anyway. Andy Biggs, who's a representative from Arizona, he's on the House Judiciary Committee, Republican, had a good op-ed in the Washington Examiner. The implication... Right. And this is sort of the D.C. press corps facilitating this. The information coming out of these behind closed doors depositions, hearings, if you will, is horrifically damaging to President Trump. And he suggests the reality, if the information was truly damaging, Democrats would hold open hearings and would already have released transcripts of the testimonies. Trump did not ask the Ukrainian president to investigate a political opponent. The Trump administration has released the transcript of the phone call, of course. So why won't the Democrats operate as transparently as the White House if they've got the goods? I mean, you certainly can't be worried about some sort of interference. That's why you do things in the open light of day, right? So that, hey, here it is. We're not going to let anybody beat us up in a back alley. We're not going to let people, we're not going to leave people to their imaginations. What they're trying to do is cook up the supporting evidence argument for a conclusion they drew on November 9th of 2016. And this is the latest iteration of that. And again, we're supposed to forget everything that they've done for 2.5 years on Russian collusion. We're supposed to forget the reporting that's been done on Ukrainian collusion with the Democrats and the Hillary Clinton campaign in 2016. We're supposed to ignore, be uninterested in whatever John Durham finds about the 2016 look back. We're supposed to be aghast that the president of the United States would suggest that foreign countries that could be relevant, their heads of state, their relevant personnel, would cooperate with a DOJ investigation. This is impeachable stuff. I mean, this isn't even close. And the more hysterical they get, the more indication how far away they are substantively. They're covering the lack of evidence with histrionics. It's an old ploy. Lefty in Naperville, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Blah, 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 blah. Blah, 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 bye-bye.
Okay.
Do you want me to translate?
Thanks for the call. Yeah.
It was a bunch of gobbledygook is what he just said.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of noise.
The whole thing, or just
no, the whole
Mulvaney thing. Or my explanation of it, or
no,
what?
No, Mulvaney going on Fox News.
Well, they're suggesting that Mulvaney should be impeached, too.
Let him
impeach everybody.
Impeach the world. It's like, so sick of impeachment. I have an impeachment hangover.
Gary Oldman and The Professional. Bring me everybody. Impeach me everybody. John in Evergreen Park.
Hey, Dan. You know, Amy hit the button right on the nail right on the head when she says, why do these people even bother to talk to anybody in the press when they're always trying to set traps for them? Why can't they keep their mouth shut and stay out of the limelight?
Well,
I'll listen for your answer.
Thanks for the call, John. I mean,
after that, he should have just gone golfing, do something.
You have to confront and make arguments. I mean, you can't hide either. You have to make arguments. You have to present.
Well, he wasn't hiding. I mean, he had a press conference at the White House, and
yeah, and that because of his imprecision with language and the back and forth with Jonathan Carl, he created a little controversy around himself that he needed to further explicate.
Right.
So, Oh, by the way, in a story that nobody cares about, The State Department completed its internal investigation into former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's use of a private email and found violations by 38 people, some of whom may face disciplinary action. Oh, heavens, please, no. violations and some may face disciplinary action. No, let's not.
No,
no let's not. They're violations, 38 people. Let's just give them, honest mistakes, I'm sure. The investigation, which was launched 3 years ago.
Oy.
38 people culpable in 91 cases of sending classified information that ended up in Hillary Clinton's personal email, according to a letter that was sent to Republican Senator Chuck Grassley this week, released on Friday. The 38 are current and former State Department officials, but were not identified. Of course not. You don't want to hold anybody accountable by name. Mm-hmm. Hillary Clinton spokesman said the email story is put to bed with a clear recognition it was a pointless crusade that took away from so many other issues we should have been discussing in 16. It was pointless. This is remarkable to me. It's like Jim Comey when he gets the IG report that indicts him for abrogating his professional responsibilities as FBI director, and he celebrates it. Clean bill of health. I told you so. 38 people violated at minimum State Department protocols, perhaps the law. We don't know. The violations will be noted in their files. Oh, boy. But 38 violations, 38 people, 91 violations. And the Hillary Clinton, I told you there was nothing to see there. What? Just amazing their ability to say, look, well, you've been convicted of a crime. I told you I didn't do it. I can beat him again. I won the election in 2016. I mean, it really is impressive their ability to create a whole different reality around themselves where the conclusions that are drawn, the evidence that presented just doesn't matter if it doesn't fit our story. I told you there was nothing there. I mean, boy, at some depraved level, you got to respect their gutsiness. Isn't that the name of the book?
Yeah. Gutsy Women.
Alpha Team. Man down, man down. I told you. Benny. Bring me everyone.
What do you mean everyone?
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we're talking about, impeachment. And by the way, just so you understand how central this is to everything the left wants to communicate, Vox.com. Yes. Liz Vathalos. Impeachment Explained, a new podcast series.
Oh, really?
You're not launching a new podcast product if you don't think this is has at least a runway through November of 2020. Bill on our Northwest Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. To add a little levity to the show, there was a movie in 1964 called Guide for the Married Man. It starred, among other people, Walter Matthau and Joey Bishop of the Rat Pack.
Oh, sure.
And in the opening scene of the movie, Joey Bishop's wife, played by Millie, who is on the Dick Van Dyke Show, the neighbor's wife, Millie walks in. Millie's kind of a drab-looking woman. She walks into the bedroom with a bag of groceries, and her husband, Joey Bishop, is in bed with the equivalent of a Playboy playmate. And she goes, Millie says, "What's that woman doing in bed with you?" And Joey Bishop goes, "What woman? I don't know what you're talking about." Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the woman gets out of bed and starts dressing. And she puts on all her clothes.
Right.
And she and Millie keeps on accusing her husband, Joey Bishop, what is that woman doing here? And Joey Bishop keeps repeating, "What woman?" And meanwhile, he pulls out a newspaper and a pipe, and he starts smoking his pipe and reading the newspaper in bed. And the woman, the hot woman, walks out of the bedroom past Millie, the wife, and gives a little toodaloo signal and says goodbye. And at the end of it, Millie is like so stunned by Joey Bishop's denial that she just starts to believe she's going crazy. And this is like Joe Biden getting caught on tape committing real, actual extortion upon Ukraine. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats have turned it into an impeachment process against President Trump. Like, what extortion? Biden didn't. What extortion about Biden? What are you talking about? But it's on tape. He's bragging about it.
I know. It's
the same thing as Guide for the Married Man. But thank you for taking
Thanks
my call.
Thanks for Bye. The call, Bill. Yeah, the Democrats are Joey Bishop and Guide to the Married Man. I mean, on a range front, Hillary, I just can't get over this. 38 people found to have violated, at minimum, State Department protocols, 91 violations.
91.
Who told you this was pointless? We told you this was a crusade. We told you you were making stuff up about Hillary in a private server. 38 people at the State Department. The AP reported it, at least.
Well, is anything going to happen to them?
Yeah, some of them may have
Oh, that's right, something in their file.
A demerit put in their permanent record. James Comey, get a clean bill of health. You failed to abide your professional responsibilities as FBI director. Hooray!
Celebrate me.
I told you there was nothing to see here.
It's just the way they sell it. That's all it is. Because people are stupid and lazy and don't read the rest of the report.
What woman?
That's what's going on. Yeah.
What woman? Perfect. Exactly.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. We have another few days, I suspect, of Chicago teacher strike theater before you have Lori Lightfoot fully cave to their demands. I mean, their real demands, not their stated demands. But before that, you've got the encouraging notes from over the weekend. You know, this is the script that we remember, if you were paying attention, from 2012.
Oh, yeah.
They're hardening. This could be a long one. We're fine on the financial stuff for our terms of salaries and benefits. But what we really need is all these new personnel for the students, because it's all about the kids. It's always all about the kids. And then there's a little give from the mayor's office, and that's a hopeful note. And there'll be a little bit more give, and then we'll settle this and walk away, and nothing will change in terms of the quality of education that's actually provided in most of the Chicago public schools. So that's sort of the trajectory we're on, and that's what you heard a little bit over the weekend.
Yeah, here's CTU Chief of Staff Jennifer Johnson, who said, you know, Dan, they could have settled this back in September.
Sure.
It shouldn't take being on strike to get the needs of our students met. But again, as we've said repeatedly, we are looking for a just contract.
Yeah, yeah, it's all about being just. And I'm a little programming note. Or a little advice from Amy, which is going to be my new segment, advice from Amy, in 10 seconds or less. If you're a teacher on strike, please don't paste on Facebook pictures of you and other striking teachers drinking bubblies at 10:30 in the morning after you get off the picket lines. Just, you know.
Why not do that?
It makes me just, yeah, it's all about the children and they're getting hammered.
Yeah, you
should. At 10:30 in the morning on Thursday and Friday. While I'm taking about 80 kids under my wing, paying for gym time to keep practicing so that we don't get slaughtered when we come back to school and play a game. So we're ready to go.
You should thank them for posting those pictures because they're telling you who they are. We know not all teachers think the same way about the teachers' union, about the strike, about K through 12 education generally. One of them who thinks a little bit differently than at least what you hear from the leadership of the Chicago Teachers Union, and frankly, the administration side too, is Joseph O'Call, who's a math teacher and chess coach with Earl STEM Academy in West Englewood. You may remember Joseph O'Call. We've had him on the show before. In fact, a couple years ago, thanks to the generosity of our listeners, we raised a few thousand dollars for his chess teams at Earl STEM. And this was when, remarkably, they were trying to eliminate his chess teams at Earl STEM Academy for these young, mainly African-American kids. Why would you want to do that? This is insane. But you know what the Chicago Teachers Union really doesn't like more than anything? What? Being shown up, being exposed for what their real interests are and what their real operation is. And it's an ideological agenda that has passing connection to educating children, as we've seen over and over and over again. But that doesn't mean that the majority of Chicago doesn't get gaslighted by that agitprop you just heard from CTU's chief of staff. Well, how about a different perspective from somebody on the other side of the wall, as it were? Joseph O'Call, again, middle school math teacher, after-school chess coach, Earl STEM Academy, West Englewood. Joseph, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Quinn. Good morning, Amy. Good morning.
Now, you're not a member of the union anymore. Because of the Janus decision, you were able to opt out, right?
Well, in 2016, there was this one-day walkout. And I decided to be with my students. I decided to cross the picket line to be with my students because I promised them that whatever happens, I'll be with them because we need to also practice in chess because we were hoping to compete in the 2016 National Chess Tournament. And I think I made the right decision because 3 weeks after, we won the national championship for the all-girls chess tournament. And I guess it was a vindication. However, I got expelled. They asked me to explain, and I did explain. I said, I don't see the relevance or the direct correlation between a teacher's pay, increasing demand for teacher's pay, and the benefit to the student. So I said, we're supposed to be teachers, and as a teacher, I just want to be with my students. I should not be outside the classroom. I have nothing against the union, but I have something against the method of pursuing their demands, where they dangle the plight of the students in the middle of the fight. And I just don't believe that, because there could be other ways, and there are other ways to fight City Hall, but you don't have to dangle the students, leave them, and us being teachers, leaving the students, neglecting the students. Mm-hmm.
So, Dr.
Kale, doesn't make sense.
What have you been doing the last 3 days for this strike? Have you been in your classroom, and are you, you know, teaching students?
Yes. Yes, I've been in my classroom, and we've been practicing. I've been getting them to do some puzzles, some classwork, some activities, including physical activities in the gym.
Well, it's got to be.
I feel that I should be with my students.
Yeah, it's got to be peaceful in the faculty lounge these days. You got that going for you. I just want to be clear. Are you a member of CTU or not?
I'm no longer a member, but however, under the law, I'm supposed to pay a certain amount to the union, considering that I'm also getting some of the benefits that they bargained for. But I brought the union to the, I filed a complaint against them because after they expelled me, they kept on deducting union dues much higher than what I'm supposed
sure,
to pay,
of course.
Much yeah. higher than other members of the union. And for the next 8 to 9 months, they kept on deducting. So I filed the case in court. And that's how I managed to get them to stop that. And I managed to also provide some information that some diehard members were bullying me. So I went to court. And I think the union should go to court if there's basis for their demands. They should not be going to the streets. They should go to court because, after all, we're a nation of court. We're a nation of laws.
Not so much in Chicago. Yeah, not really in Chicago.
So do you have a school nurse at your middle school, and do you have a counselor? And if not, do you think one is needed?
We have a school nurse who comes, but I guess it's not every day. But I just want to point out that in my school, we're about 30 teachers. There's only one who got an oversized class. And this has even been remedied. Most of us have undersized class.
Mm-hmm.
Undersized. So actually, we don't have enough students. And I think that's the trend in the rest of Chicago public schools. We don't have enough students. So we're losing in terms of student population. It's decreasing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So what's the issue? I mean, I think we should be campaigning even for more students.
Yeah, well,
but we have a lot of teachers with undersized classes.
Sure,
not oversized classes.
It's going to be a tough campaign
here.
Yeah, it's a tough campaign to keep people in Chicago, much less attract them to move here. Yeah, that's a real problem. It's interesting. I'm glad you said that because it certainly runs counter to what you're hearing from the Chicago Teachers Union, to no surprise. I wonder of those 30 teachers at Earl STEM Academy and other teachers, colleagues of yours in the Chicago public school system, what are your conversations with them like about the strike, about the positions that you've taken, about teaching in CPS? Can you give us some insights there?
I have been having a cordial relationship with most of them. They understand my stand. I explained to them my stand. I said, I just want to be my students. That's the bottom line. I just want to be with them. We are teachers. We have a responsibility to our students. I joined Chicago Public Schools as a teacher, not to be a union member. First and foremost, my responsibility is to my students, not with my peers. Not in the streets, but inside my classroom. That's the bottom line. Now, there are other ways to fight City Hall. I have nothing against the union, but I have something against their method of pursuing their demands.
And by the way, just
demands always in the streets.
Yeah, just as a point of order, you said you're still paying union dues. I mean, you know, under the Janus decision, you don't have to pay fair share if you don't want to.
I've been deducted fair share for some time.
Well,
but
you should get that money back.
But I think there's also a recent decision by the Supreme Court that no one can be compelled to be a member of the union.
That's right, James.
Because I'm working for CPS. I'm not working for the union.
Okay.
I'm working for CPS, and I'm a teacher there.
All right.
Well, have any of the fellow teachers want to join you in getting out of the union?
Well, I don't know yet, but what I heard is that there are also other teachers who didn't join the strike. But in my school, I'm the only teacher who didn't join the strike.
Yeah,
and
of course.
I had my students, and the students, the number of students has been increasing. We have more students last Friday, so I think today, no classes, but I'll get more students. I'll get more students. I think a number of them has realized this ridiculousness of the strike,
where they
lose. It's the students who lose this fight. This is the kind of fight that should not have been after all done.
Joseph O'Call, Earl STEM Academy. How's the chess team, your chess teams, doing there? I know this program was off and running a few years ago, and you were, as you mentioned, you were winning championships with your girls and whatnot. How is it going?
Girls, Dan.
Well, last school year, we won fourth place in the nationals.
Nice.
And we were the only CPS school that won in the 2016 National Junior High Chess Tournament. So three of my kids also won individual medals. The only CPS students and the only CPS school.
Do you know offhand how many CPS schools have chess programs like Earl STEM does because of you?
I don't know, but I know the number of teams has been increasing for some time.
That's good.
And other schools, they have been also doing their own programs with practice. The challenge that we face actually is on the funding. So I told the kids, just keep on hoping and keep on praying, but we should not be demanding. It's not the way to, you know, you just have to prove and show to the world that you can earn it. And show to the world that if you be given the opportunity to shine, you can shine.
Yeah,
you have to be demanding. You have to do it.
Yeah. It's remarkable that they can't seem to scrape together a few shekels for a chess program at Earl STEM Academy, and how important that is and how successful it's been under your stewardship. Can't find money for that while we're talking about 16% raises and a couple billion dollars in support staff personnel and so forth. Can't seem to find a couple grand for the chess program at Earl STEM. Isn't that interesting?
Thank you for, it's a number of donors came and helped us in the past.
Yes.
So I'm just hoping that we'll have another opportunity to be able to compete this school year.
What do the parents say, the kids that you coach? What do they say about that program and what's going on in Earl STEM?
Oh, they're so proud because for the past 4 years, the valedictorians, the salutatorians of our school came chess players. There's a direct correlation between chess and the academics.
Yeah.
Because in chess, it's not just about the game. It's about life. You teach them about life, the values of life. Every piece in the chess board has something to do with life. It has some representation about how it is. It's like the pawn. That's the lowest. The lowest we can relate ourselves. I mean, I told my students we can relate ourselves to pawn. But of all the pieces on the chessboard, the pawn is the only one that can become the most powerful piece, and can become a queen. And the queen can be the most powerful one.
Yes, so, amen.
I like, that's a great metaphor. No, I like, it's very
love
good.
It.
I like, what about, maybe we should do like a big event where like one of your top chess players takes on Deep Blue like Garry Kasparov did, some kind of event to draw more attention to the chess program. What do you think?
Well, we're hoping we'll get that opportunity. But, I tell my kids that just be thankful that we get some blessings. And keep on thanking. Yeah, we cannot get everything in this world, and that's what I want to relate to the union. This is not just about money. This is not just about power, grabbing power. No, I mean, look at the blessings, not just all the problems. But, first and foremost, just don't peddle lies and exaggerations, and where you dangle the kids' plight. These losses that the kids are having, it's difficult really to recover that. They lost this instructional time for some time now. And how do you recover that?
Joseph, I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I just hope that this strike will, you know, people will come to their senses that it's the students that are losing here. Not the adults, the students.
Joseph Ocal, a math teacher and chess coach at Earl STEM Academy in West Englewood. Joseph, thanks for joining us. Good to catch up with you. Good to hear that you're still doing that great work and the kids are taken to chess. And hopefully they'll get back. All of them will get back formally under your leadership and mentorship here soon. But we appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak.
And the only teacher still teaching during this three-day strike. He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Hillary Clinton and Tulsi Gabbard getting into this. Maybe they'll soon be able to get into this on a debate stage when Hillary Clinton enters the race for president, hopefully before the year's out. Hillary Clinton on this podcast with David Plouf, former Obama flack.
He's got a podcast. With his work.
Oh, yeah. He turned out to be a capitalist. Went to work for Uber, among other clients. Hillary Clinton on Tulsi Gabbard. You know, anybody who is not on board with the leftist orthodoxy, you know what they are. They're a Russian asset.
I think it's going to be the same as 2016. Don't vote for the other guy. You don't like me? Don't vote for the other guy because the other guy is going to do X, Y, and Z. Or the other guy did such terrible things. I'm going to show you in these, you know, flashing videos that appear and then disappear and they're on the dark web and nobody can find them. But you're going to see them and you're going to see that person doing these horrible things. They're also going to do third party again. And I'm not making any predictions, but I think they've got their eye on somebody who's currently in the Democratic primary. And are grooming her to be the third-party candidate. Mm-hmm. She's the favorite of the Russians. They have a bunch of sites and bots and other ways of supporting her so far. And that's assuming Jill Stein will give it up, which she might not because she's also a Russian asset.
Yeah,
she's a Russian asset. I mean, totally. And so they know they can't win without a third-party candidate. And so I don't know who it's going to be, but I will guarantee you they'll have a vigorous third-party challenge in the key states that they most need it.
Tulsi Gabbard is Jill Stein as Russian asset third party 2020. Tulsi Gabbard didn't take too kindly to the obvious reference to her.
She didn't take long to respond either. It was great.
Calling Hillary Clinton the rod of the Democrat Party, a madam warmonger, and releasing this video statement.
People warned me in 2016 that my endorsement of Bernie Sanders would be the end of my quote-unquote political career. They said Clinton will never forget that she and her rich and powerful friends, her allies in politics and in the media, will make sure that you are destroyed. Well, there have been countless hit pieces full of smears against me from day one of this campaign. They've tried to destroy my reputation and my lifetime of service because I stood up to them. I've spent over 16 years of my life proudly serving in the Army National Guard. I still serve as a major today. I volunteered to deploy to the Middle East twice. I've served in Congress now for nearly 7 years, serving on the Foreign Affairs Committee, the Armed Services Committee, the Homeland Security Committee, and I am not afraid to openly express my love for our country. But if they can falsely portray me as a traitor, then they can do it to anyone. And in fact, that's exactly the message that they want to get across to you. That if you stand up against Hillary and the party power brokers, if you stand up to the rich and powerful elite and the war machine, they will destroy you and discredit your message. But here is the truth. They will not intimidate us. They will not silence us. We are not here just to protest their corruption. I am running for president to take the Democratic Party and our country back from the corrupt elite. I'm running for president to bring about a new Democratic Party and new leadership that will fight for peace, fight for the people, and protect our planet. So I want to ask every single one of you to join me in speaking truth to power. Don't be afraid. Let's root out the corruption in our party and our country. Join me to end the war machine stranglehold over our leaders and ensure that our government is truly of the people, by the people, and for the people.
Sound like a third party candidate to you?
Not really.
Russian plant, Dan?
I also, you know, it's fun. I mean, I enjoy the Manchurian candidate as much as the next guy.
Yes.
But when you're going to accuse people of being traitors, of committing treason, or being groomed to commit treason, you know, maybe they were programmed, and so they don't even know they're committing treason, whatever your conspiracy theory is, I like to see some evidence, maybe. Especially after we've gone through 2.5 years of accusing the President of the United States of being a traitor, committing
Russian
treason. Yeah, being the Manchurian candidate for Putin. Putin's man in D.C., sans evidence. I don't know. That's me, though. I'm a bit of a stickler when it comes to that. For more on the topic, we're pleased to be joined by Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Author of books including Wiki at War and Private Sector Public Wars. Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good to be with you.
So what do you think? How concerned should we be that the Russians may get their hands on Tulsi and prevent Hillary Clinton from being president again?
Yeah, well, you know, I do policy, not politics. I don't comment on candidates and what candidates do. I will say I don't think the Russians have a lot of assets in the United States. I mean, we all know that Russians have tried to interfere with U.S. elections, and they've had very targeted influence campaigns. What I don't see a lot of is, where's the evidence that Russian meddling actually moves the needle here? Not that we shouldn't hold the Russians accountable, not that it's not a really bad thing, but 330 million Americans who I think are more than capable of making up their minds for themselves. And you know, so sometimes I think we kind of overplay this Russian concern and to essentially elevate our own politics. And I think this is the message here is things have become so cutthroat. People are so over the top that basically now, in order to get heard in the noise, you can say anything about anybody without a shred of credibility. And everybody just says, well, that's just politics. That's okay. So we've lost this sense of kind of responsible decorum that we used to have in American politics.
And Hillary Clinton sounded so vile and so, I mean, this gross accusation that she made, is it a possibility? Do you think that she might still run for president in 2020?
I have no idea because I really don't follow politics that closely. I do find it interesting that what people accuse Trump of, they do in spades in terms of just completely jumping the shark in their rhetoric. And then they turn right around and they hit him for the same thing. You know, the reason why I think we've been so successful in kind of analyzing the administration, what their policies are, the real impact they have is just kind of trying to shut the rhetoric out and recognize it for what it is and look at what people actually do. So we could talk about Gabbard's foreign policy, which I actually think is horrible. I mean, I think 99% of her foreign policy proposals are nuts.
Well, let's mention that.
But that's a different issue, right? Well, that's the real issue.
Yeah, let's mention that just for a minute, because I made this point last week. Like, just because she's not liked by CNN, and the New York Times, and Hillary Clinton, and is liked by Trey Gowdy, doesn't make her substantively interesting. And I talk most specifically about some of her views on domestic politics. But talk to us a little bit about her national security chops now that she's under a little bit more scrutiny.
Well, I mean, I think there is, and this is not, it's not Democrat, it's not Republican. There is a wing of, you know, foreign policy in this town or in the country that believes that the answer is to just walk away from everything, right? That, you know, we shouldn't be here, we shouldn't be there, and we should just pull all our troops home and mind our own business. The problem with that logic is, you know, we actually tried that under the Obama administration. We tried walking away from everything, and all we did was create space and gaps for bad guys to fill and make life harder for it. Even the criticism on Trump in Syria is a bit off base. We're not, and again, the rhetoric aside of whatever the president might or might not have said, we moved troops from northern Syria to western Iraq. you know, in terms of our fundamental missions that we're doing in Syria, counterterrorism, that's just a line in the sand. I mean, that is not strategically much of a difference, and it's certainly not walking away from the Middle East. So I just think, you know, foreign policies are just myopically, let's just walk away from everything. I don't have much to do with that.
Why were the troops moved there?
Well, I think it's safer for the troops. I think that's the short answer. We could leave them in the middle of a shooting war between the YPG and Turkey. We could hope that the ceasefire would hold and people would stop shooting. But the reality is in terms of the counterterrorism mission in the region, I actually think that the U.S. forces can do them just fine for Western Iraq. I think the reason why some people wanted troops to stay in Syria is I think they had this belief that somehow the U.S. was going to affect the outcome of the civil war in Syria and, you know, which sections got more power or less power. And we never had enough troops to do that. We never had enough influence to do that. And in reality, it never made sense for American foreign policy to do that. So, you know, I might occasionally agree with Gabbard or Senator Rand Paul, or a Republican, on some things. Like, I never thought the Libyan invasion was U.S. engaging in Libya was a good idea to begin with, right? But I think, you know, sometimes those things are happenstance. What we always do is we don't say invade, don't invade, walk away, you know, double down. What we say is what is the vital national interest of the United States? What are the capabilities you have available? What's the most efficacious way to do them? And that's what we say you should do. And whether a politician says they agree or disagree, you know, we just call balls and strikes on that. We don't pick sides. But I think it's very, very difficult to hear that kind of analysis and discussion among political candidates when it's all just people screaming at each other.
There's an interesting piece by Council on Foreign Relations, a fellow over the weekend in Wall Street Journal. The narrative on this is that, you know who's happy? You know who's happy about Trump's decision? Iran is happy. Assad is happy. Turkey's happy. All of our enemies are happy. Perhaps it's a bit more complicated than that. Just 2 points. The argument that's offered by this Council on Foreign Relations policy guy is, number one, Assad has dreams of unifying Syria that have always run into Iranian resistance. This may less limit his ambitions to consolidate power in the territory. Number two, without the U.S. In presence, Iran's attempts at persuasion will do little to restrain Syria as well. He suggests that in Syria, Ankara is bound to be more powerful, Mr. Assad more reckless, the Kurds substantially weakened, the Islamic State reconstituted. None of that is good news for Iran either.
Well, you know, people never ask the question is how could a couple of hundred Americans jump into the middle of a Syrian civil war and organize a war against the caliphate? And the answer to that's really simple. It's because everybody let them. The Iranians, the Russians, Assad, the Turks, YPG, nobody wanted the caliphate there. And they were happy to let the Americans do that. I think people confuse that somehow that small American presence that can organize operations against the caliphate was sufficient to restrain other people's ambitions in Syria. And it wasn't. It never was. It was a speed bump. Iran and Russia have always had Assad in their orbit. That doesn't change. I don't think their position's substantially improved. There's kind of no place for them to go. The Russians, they're not going to push for more than Damascus and the port. That's all they really care about. And if they wanted to, where could they go? They go south, they bump into Turkey, they bump into Israel, they bump into Iran. Similarly, Iran goes, it bumps into Israel. Matter of fact, we had a case not long ago where the Russians were standing back while the Israelis were killing or bombing Iranian assets in Syria. So the Iran doesn't have a place to go, and they're also overstretched. So I mean, I saw that article, and I read it, and I said, well, what does this have to do with the reality of what's actually going on the ground and the history of what we've seen over the last 10 years? I mean, it just seems to me it starts with a premise that whatever Trump did is wrong and it has to fail. And so let me come up with some explanations, but it's not based on anything that we've actually seen in Syria happen in the last decade.
But the other takeaway, my other takeaway from that, I get your point, was this idea that, the U.S. withdrawal just makes everybody happy and further empowers enemies of the United States. It's a lot more complicated than that because there are tensions with respect to the power relationships between these other actors.
Right. So what happens is by pulling the U.S. out of the picture, which arguably it never was, this notion that somehow the U.S. was tipping the balance of power in the Civil War, I just think that's simply not true. Mm-hmm. But the reality is the U.S. helped get rid of the caliphate, and what everybody did was they just went back to squabbling over their little piece of Syria, which is what was happening before the U.S. went in. And I don't think the U.S. was capable of affecting that dynamic. And I don't think if one side had the capacity or capability to win the Syrian civil war and take advantage of the violence and the chaos, dude, they'd have done that 10 years ago. But they don't. And so I think we go back to where we were before, which is everybody just kind of squabbling over Syria.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, Vice President of the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Jim, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, it's a great conversation. Thank you, guys.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Time now for another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Yeah, it takes us across the pond, this installment, to England. Valerie Neal, formerly Sanders, admitted to nagging her husband, but denied committing a criminal offense.
She wanted him to pick up his clothes, maybe put the dishes in the dishwasher.
She said her husband was obsessed with the gym. Why? Because she's not there.
What he works out, yeah.
She admitted asking her bodybuilder ex, Michael, to vacuum more.
See? Yes.
But she
put his dishes in the dishwasher?
She crossed over to a polite request. She crossed over from a polite request to over-controlling behavior, which is a criminal offense, at least in North Yorkshire over there in England. And bully for them, I say. And why don't we have these enlightened laws in this country?
Oh, because she nagged him, now she's going to jail?
She would also leave him notes about cleaning.
Yeah, pick up after yourself. I'm not your mom.
She says...
And if you don't, I'm not going to let you out of the house to go to the gym. Good for her. Got to set down the rules, Dan.
Well,
lay down the hammer.
Yeah, well, she says she now wishes she had her day in court to prove she did nothing more than ask him to help out around the house. They didn't make it, by the way, the marriage.
Oh, the marriage?
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm. All I ever asked my husband to do was vacuum the house, make me a cup of tea, wipe marks off the patio doors. If that's nagging, I'll hold up my hands to it, but asking your husband to vacuum is not, in my eyes, a criminal offense. Well, that's where we part company.
A criminal offense? Mm-hmm. What? That better not come to America. That'll never happen here. Never.
Yeah.
Is she good looking?
They wed in 2014, although tensions soon developed over cleaning. Boy. If you had a nickel for every time you heard that story. Yeah. Boy, the honeymoon didn't last there.
It's just another mouth to feed and somebody else to clean up after, really, when you think about it.
What?
Who needs that? A husband.
Oh, this is an argument why Amy, well.
Yeah. I'm just saying women know that we have to clean up after our kids and clean up after your husbands.
Coercive and controlling behavior in the UK, by the way, you may want to contact your legislator about this. Carries a maximum sentence of 5 years. Yeah. Now, here's the interesting thing. The majority of prosecutions, 97% in England and Wales in 2016, are against men.
Oh.
And that's why Dan Proft is single, because even if we had these laws, not enough women would be prosecuted.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Tickets for Freedom Summit Chicago are on sale now at freedomsummitchicago.com. That's freedomsummitchicago.com.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Did you see this bizarre story about Mitt Romney?
Oh, that he's got a Twitter handle. His real name is Pierre Delecto? That sounds like a male stripper name, doesn't it? And now, welcome to the stage, ladies, Pierre Delecto. Isn't he delicious? Yeah.
Yeah, in flagrante Delecto, which this is so interesting to me. He has this he had this fake account, apparently, that he used to sort of follow politicos he wanted to follow and also make, critical remarks of Trump and the like.
But he didn't want to, he wasn't man enough to follow him on his own real account, so he had this fake account.
Are people becoming more, I mean, this predates Trump, but are people becoming more like Trump? I mean, remember Trump's alter ego press agent, John Barron?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's like what Cheryl Atkinson said to Howard Kurtz about the question as to whether the President Trump has made the D.C. press corps lose their mind. And her response was, did he make them lose their mind, or did he just expose the fact that they had lost their mind? Those are different questions. And I sort of feel that way about Mitt Romney's Carlos Danger impersonation here.
Well, he's following 668 people, and again, he's just making sure, you know, to monitor political news and commentary.
I'll tell you what, for an effete gentleman like Mitt Romney, Pierre certainly is the right name that he chose. And by the way, the weak link in the Senate when it comes to standing up against the leftist conspiracy theorists, this is why Romney has already drawn a hit ad from Club for Growth, running this ad on Fox stations in Utah.
Slick, slippery, stealthy. Mitt Romney had us fooled.
Being in Donald Trump's magnificent hotel and having his endorsement is a delight.
Posing as a Republican, he tried to infiltrate Trump's administration as Secretary of State.
President-elect Trump is the very man who can lead us to that better future.
Now his cover's blown. Exposed by news reports as a Democrat secret asset. Sources say Romney's plotting to take down President Trump with impeachment. Tell Romney, quit colluding with Democrats on impeachment.
And tell Pierre Delecto, too,
Pierre
while
Delecto.
You're at it. Just bizarre.
It's so bizarre. It's so goofy.
As buttoned down as Mitt Romney presents himself to be. And, I mean, you know, in terms of, like, a life well-lived, we talked about that when we ran for president in 2012. You know, this seems to be, like, straight-laced, buttoned-down guy as there has ever run for president, much less been president. But then the other part of it is, you know, he's a cutthroat private equity guy too, and
he's got an alter ego, yeah.
And he's slippery, and he's transactional. He's not principled, and thus his foray into government-run healthcare in Massachusetts. And you know, the thing that he aspires to is status. No question about it. He sees politics as status, not as certainly not as a street fight. Maybe not even public service. I don't know. But he feels like he is one of the philosopher kings that should be genuflected before, and his more recent behavior seems to remind us of that in case we had forgotten it in 2012. For more on this topic and so many others, we're pleased to be joined by Dominic Green, life and arts editor for Spectator USA, contributor to the Wall Street Journal and the New Criterion. Dominic, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. I'm in Parliament Square in London. I'm here for a little bit of Brexit, and we're waiting for the big vote today.
Yeah.
On Saturday, as you hear, Boris Johnson tried to get his deal through the Parliament, but he was ambushed by people on his own side, and they added an amendment, making it impossible for him to move the deal through. But they're going to try again this afternoon.
Ambushed by people on his own side, that says a familiar ring to it. Before we talk more about Brexit, what's your handle on the impeachment melodrama playing out and sort of slippery actors like Mitt Romney on technically inside the Trump perimeter?
Well, my first understanding is that this is the surest way to boost Donald Trump's chances of re-election in 2020. Out impeachment business, which is, I don't believe it's going to get anywhere, but it's going to be a long and embarrassing theatrical. And I think any Republicans who try and work the angles on this are also going to damage their prospects in the same way as the Democrats are.
Are the people over there following, are, you know, the debates that we're having and any of that?
Yes, they are. A lot of people here obviously are not aware of the difference in nuance between impeachment as a legal process and the impeachment inquiry, which we currently have, which of course is more an attempt to turn up some dirt in a long-running dig. But they are following very closely. And the division between ordinary opinion and elite opinion that you see in the U.S. is pretty much replicated here when it comes to attitudes towards Donald Trump, or indeed in attitudes towards Brexit.
And so it's fascinating. So Boris Johnson is able to get a deal in principle with the EU. Apparently some in his own party thought that wasn't going to happen. And even though it did happen, they're still willing to fall on that sword despite public support. Obviously, that's why this process was launched. Public support to get out of the EU.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this is a very clear-cut case of the parliament thinking they know better than the people. They made the mistake of asking the people's opinion. They got a very clear answer. And now they're charged with executing it in legislative terms. And people said, as you're saying, that Johnson would have no chance of getting a new deal with Brussels in 100 days, but he's managed it. And then it comes to the parliament and people in his own party, the Conservative Party, who are not reconciled to Britain leaving the European Union, are doing anything they can to block the process. So they tripped him up. But if I'm, as a gambling man, I would reckon that they're going to squeeze it through. I was talking with one of Spectator's lobby correspondents who's been in and out of Downing Street on a daily basis over the last week. And their feeling is they have the numbers, that there'll be defectors from the Labour Party, pro-Brexit Labour Party MPs who might make up the difference, and they could well get it over the line. The difficulty is, of course, that they may get over the line attached to a ball and chain, because a further amendment may be attached demanding a second referendum, which will return everybody back to square one, to endorse, in other words, the deal that they've got. And this is really a stratagem for undoing Brexit, for reversing it, for restoring control over politics to the people who think they know best.
So, I mean, it's sort of the Brexit was a popular uprising, much like we've had with Trump. And you see that, do you see the energy behind that popular uprising against the ruling class? Is that really Boris Johnson's secret weapon here to get this done?
Yes, and it is. And of course, Boris is a member of the ruling class, if ever there was one. Mm. You know, he's a classicist, and he's been to Eton, and he was born in New York City, even. Yep. But he most definitely has what they call the common touch. And this morning in Parliament Square, when I was looking around, you know, there are crowds of people waving Union Jack flags or European Union flags, depending on which side they're on. Things are fairly cheerful this morning. There's no scenes like there were on Saturday after the vote. Then members of the government who left the House of Commons on foot had to be given police escorts because the crowds were so angry. But absolutely, there's a massive popular energy attached to this, and any attempt to head it off or to wait it out is mistaken. Last week, the polls had 65% of British people, whichever way they voted 3 years ago, just saying they want to get it done, get on with it, and so on. And that's a pretty conclusive public opinion in favor of finishing the process and getting out.
The mainstream media here is focusing on Johnson's two letters that he sent to the EU on Saturday, one requesting a Brexit extension and the other arguing against it. Is yes. there any truth to that? And what is that all about?
Oh, it was he got his hand tied basically by the parliament saying, if you don't have a deal, we can't leave on October the 31st, you know, 10 days from now. And him and his advisors came up with this wheeze whereby, yes, they'd send the letter that they were legally obliged to send, except they sent it as a photocopy and he didn't sign it. And then he attached this letter to it, basically saying, this is Parliament's will. This is a legal obligation. This is not what I want at all. And he reminded the EU leaders in the second letter that any delay would be bad, not just for British economy, but also for the EU economy. And let's not forget that the Eurozone, which uses the euro currency, the Eurozone is slipping into recession. Germany is heading that way, France that way as well. They're not interested in further economic distress. And so Boris's secret weapon, as it were, in today's vote is that the European Union, which has been quite antagonistic in the negotiating period, is actually now on his side in the sense that they also want to get this wrapped up on time on October the 31st.
And what was Boris Johnson able to do to cajole the EU to change their tune?
Well, the big sticking point previously was the status of Northern Ireland, and the parties came up with a fudge, really. Northern Ireland, you know, is part of the United Kingdom, but of course the Republic of Ireland is an EU state. Under the New Deal, Northern Ireland would remain in the UK's customs zone, which means it would benefit from any of the free trade deals that Britain could then strike, for instance, the one that Donald Trump has spoken about. But Northern Ireland will also remain inside the EU's regulatory zone. So, of course, the unionists in Northern Ireland, the ones who want to be in the UK, they're furious about this, and they have a point because in their terms, yes, this sets the North on a path towards reunification with the Republic. And if you were to ask me, I would say that that's the long-term historical drift anyway, and it's going to happen sooner or later, and it may well turn out to be the price tag for getting the rest of the UK out of the EU.
Before we let you go, being a man of letters, the life and arts editor for Spectator USA, Dominic Green, I wanted to get your comment on the passing of really famed humanities professor at Yale, Harold Bloom, passed away last week. I mean, he was a fierce defender of the Western canons, particularly Shakespeare, which isn't even required in like 47 of the top 50 English departments in America these days to be an English major. Sort of remarkable. We're in a situation now where you're not allowed to be graded on the quality of your writing, just the effort you put into it. I mean, and that's at the collegiate level. So we've gone about as far away from the idea of the humanities and literature as we can from what Harold Bloom thought about it. And I just sort of wanted to remark on his passing and get your reaction.
I thought Harold Bloom was a tremendous American scholar. And I mean that in the sense that he was a world-class scholar, but he was also a uniquely American kind of scholar. He was in the lineage, I would say, of Emerson and Whitman, people who were enormously passionate and inspiring about literature, who understood that the love of good books is something which makes people better citizens in some way. And so, yes, it is a tragedy. And Harold Bloom was very vocal about what was going on, you know, in the universities. He was openly hostile, and of course everyone else was openly hostile to him about this.
Yes.
But I believe he stood up for the best and so on, not just in literature, but in the way that it helps us all become better people.
He is Dominic Green, life and arts editor of Spectator USA. Dominic, thanks for joining us, and good luck with Brexit out there.
We'll need it. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Amy.
God bless, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
We were going to discuss this story, at least I wanted to, on Friday, because our superintendent of police fell asleep at the wheel at 12:30 a.m. Here's the dispatch call when people came by and noticed that somebody was taking a little nappy noopy in their car.
Person slumped over the wheel, 34th place in Aberdeen. Aberdeen in 34th place. Caller said there's a person asleep at the stop sign in a black Chevy Tahoe.
And that person that was asleep was our Superintendent Johnson, and he came out right away and had really an exhaustive press conference where members from the media kept asking, but no, really, why did you fall asleep? And he kept repeating that the unusual incident was caused by a change in his blood pressure medication.
So while off duty, I was out with a group of friends for dinner and didn't have any feelings or symptoms of impairment or side effects from my medication when I left the restaurant.
2 minutes, stations, 2 minutes away.
And that, sorry, I don't know what that gave him. But then he never said that he was drinking, nothing.
Somebody being asleep in a car doesn't mean they're impaired in any way.
But guess what?
I like that. By the way, that statement is great. As a criminal defense attorney friend of mine pointed out, that is a statement that is not going to be used for everyone who is arrested for DUI.
Yeah.
It's going to be the Eddie Johnson defense.
Because guess who called him out? It was our own Mayor Lightfoot, who sat down with Fran Spielman from the Sun-Times, and she asked her point blank, what did he tell you happened? Was he drinking?
Did you ask him if he'd been drinking?
I didn't ask him that question specifically. He revealed to me that he'd had a couple of drinks with dinner.
Oh, he did. And is that okay? Is that okay? Should he have been driving then?
Well, look, again, I'm going to let the investigation play itself out. He's a grown man.
No. You, Mayor Lightfoot, you say you don't drink and drive. He makes enough money where, and he has access to a driver. Dan, I don't know if you knew that. So he doesn't have to drive himself home late at night after getting his drink on with his buddies. And he admitted that he was drinking and driving. Should he be arrested because he was drinking and driving?
You need evidence to arrest somebody. He had a couple of drinks with dinner. That's not the same thing as saying that he would have blown hot.
Okay. Well, he wasn't. They didn't give him a breathalyzer because it's
so
their boss.
So you don't know.
Yeah, and he lied to them. He lied to the people of the city of Chicago, and he said, it was just a medication. They changed my medication. That's why I fell asleep at the wheel at a stop sign. He could have killed somebody. He could have killed himself. Well, I mean, it's just different roles for different people, and I'm sick of it.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. A lot of activity on Saturday. You had,
Bernie's back.
Yeah, that was secondary. Obviously, the big news on Saturday was the National Period Day rallies.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. 59 rallies, including D.C., rallying for against menstrual inequity and for, I guess, menstrual justice.
And some of the signs that they brought out, it was not just women, but men, too, holding signs that said, period proud. Another one, armed schools with tampons, not guns. Another one, I already have 7 periods to worry about at school. I don't need another one.
Can you arm schools with tampons and guns? Are they mutually exclusive? Well, I'll tell you, I menstruated on Saturday in solidarity.
Honor. I knew you would.
And then I was all worn out. I could barely pay attention to the hours-long rally that Bolshevik Bernie had put together by his friends, AOC and Michael Moore, the not-dead-yet rally for Bernie there in Queens.
25,000 people were there. It was pretty impressive.
Oh, it was very impressive. And Michael Moore kicked off the festivities.
I remember asking Bernie back then, what exactly is a democratic socialist? And he said, it's very simple. It's what the Democratic Party used to be.
It's an infectious laugh.
It's what Franklin Roosevelt did.
Yeah, it is. Yes, it is. It's what Franklin Delano Roosevelt did. Yes, big social engineering government programs. There's no question about it. I like that they're getting back to their roots and speaking truth to the powers that be.
The powers that be are very unhappy that you're here. They're very unhappy that Bernie is back.
He sounds so weird, like slimy.
Bernie's back, and by the way, if you think he's too old, he's not too old. You know it's too old?
What?
All kinds of other stuff.
So what do they say? Bernie's too old! Yeah? Well, here's what's too old. The Electoral College is too old!
The Constitution! That's too old! Constitution's too old!
$25 minimum wage! That's too old!
Yeah, fossil fuels are too old. They're fossils. They're old.
It's all.
AOC.
Was AOC any better?
Oh, she was fantastic. AOC.
You know me.
Not only at the rally, but she cut a promotional video as well where she's really defined the working class revolution that has to take place.
We need to have a revolution of working class people, and it needs to be multiracial, multigendered, multigenerational. Our future is not going to get better unless we demand it and unless we work for it.
You know, it's too old. The male-female binary gender construct.
Too old.
Thank you. Thank you. Please. Thank you. And AOC offered a little retrospective on all that Bernie has meant to her life, the struggles that Bernie helped her overcome on the road from being a waitress at a taqueria to Congress.
Last February, I was working as a waitress in a downtown
cocktail bar
Manhattan.
I met you.
At a taqueria.
Turn me on.
I worked
Don't you
shoulder to Bernie. Shoulder
with undocumented workers
you feel
who often worked harder and hardest for the least amount of money. I was on my feet working 12-hour days.
So what? So did I.
With no structured breaks.
Oh, God.
I didn't have health care. I wasn't being paid a living wage.
Oh, my God.
And I didn't think that I deserved any of those things. Because that is the script
was a man.
That we tell working people here and all over this country. That your inherent worth and value as a human being is dependent on an income that another person decided to underpay us. But what we're here to do is to turn around that very basic logic.
All right, the proletariat revolution started in Queens. Can it carry Bolshevik Bernie the nomination? For more on this topic, politics 2020, we're pleased to be joined again by David Drucker, senior political correspondent for the Washington Examiner. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good to be here. Thank you.
So, big turnout for Bernie. I mean, he's got a loyal following, but it seems increasingly like it's a high floor and a low ceiling, and it's not going to be enough to keep him, in the race past, say, South Carolina.
Right. Well, we don't know exactly when Bernie will drop out because he's got a very loyal base of small donors. And if they keep giving, maybe he stays in the race because the way he sees it, even if he can't win the primary, this is how he influences policy.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think you're correct that he has a really high hill to climb to try and win the primary. I think there for progressives that want a real ambitious sort of leftism, they're getting that from Elizabeth Warren, who's also younger and more energetic and more dynamic, frankly. There are plenty of choices in this primary. So Bernie Sanders has a loyal following. I've never felt that he was in a front running position to win the primary. However, if he were to win Iowa or finish a very close second, something like that, he could roll into New Hampshire, which is, fertile territory for him in many respects, and he could surprise.
You just said Elizabeth Warren, who's younger than him. She's 70 years old.
That's younger.
Yeah, that makes a big difference in presidential politics, though. Between when you're 78 or 70, I mean, that's a huge difference. She also kind of presents as a young 70. I mean,
she does.
I mean, she's very dynamic on the trail, which I think is surprising a lot of people. Because she started out the campaign and it seemed like she was sort of a one-note candidate. And, policy aside, if you've watched her on the stump, I can see a lot of the reasons why many Democrats find her appealing.
Yeah, and it's been interesting as she has risen to sort of perceived front-runner status. There's been a good deal of concern expressed openly by opinion writers and politicos on the left about her prospects to win if she's the nominee. And so now you're seeing people take, after the last debate, take another look at Mayor Pete. You're having more chatter about, a white knight from stage left appearing. Is Michael Bloomberg going to get in? Is Hillary Clinton going to get in? Is somebody else going to get in? What's your handle on whether or not the field has rounded out, number one? And number two, I mean, could the Democrats actually nominate Mayor Pete if there's enough concern about Elizabeth Warren?
Well, look, I think Pete Buttigieg is a very charismatic candidate. He's the sort of young, charismatic politician that Democrats tend to nominate from time to time. And when Democrats win presidential elections, it's often with candidates like him. I mean, think Bill Clinton, think Barack Obama, JFK, and so it's sort of a regular occurrence for Democrats. His issue, I've always felt, has just been his age. He is under 40, and I think that's his biggest challenge.
Well,
I'm
sorry to interrupt, but his age also, he's the mayor of a 100,000-person town.
Right. I don't think that's his biggest challenge, because I think a lot of Americans have concluded that political pedigree doesn't matter as much. I mean, you can look at President Trump. That's an example of that. He was the first person we had elected in modern times, maybe ever, who wasn't at least a general, if not, you know, a cabinet member or elected some previous office of some kind.
Yeah, but success.
So I think for Pete, it's age, but he's running a good campaign and raising a lot of money. I don't see somebody coming out of the blue and getting in like a Bloomberg or anybody else. The organizing starts so early that you can't just parachute in anymore the way you used to. I also don't know how a Bloomberg type would parachute in and somehow steal the heart of the Democratic base,
right?
Especially when you have Warren running such a good campaign, and she's so organized and she's doing well with that sector of the party. I do think it's possible we will see movement. I think that, you know, let's see how things look at the beginning of January, and it's possible that the front runners will have new company, or that one of the front runners could be replaced by a late-breaking challenger into that field from the existing candidate field. You can't rule that out.
But what about people that are not, you know, declared right now, such as Hillary Clinton? Then you keep hearing rumors about Michelle Obama.
I'll go back to what I just said. Nobody is going to jump in late and somehow, you know, I don't like to use the word steal because everybody thinks rigged these days, but like, nobody's going to come in and usurp all of the candidates that are running. I mean, yeah, maybe one individual in the Democratic Party could do that. His name's Barack Obama, and he's termed out.
With respect to Joe Biden, are you of the opinion, as some are, Dan Henninger wrote in the Wall Street Journal last week, Joe's just not going to make it again. He's sputtering. And also, too, and this is sort of an underappreciated aspect of this, you were just talking about how much money Mayor Pete is raising and has on hand. Joe Biden, on the other hand, has only a third of the money on hand that Mayor Pete does, and he's spending it seemingly at a faster rate.
Yeah, so Joe Biden has challenges, and I think that, you know, one, he's been, until the debate that just occurred, he was the only one everybody was attacking. Then you have, you know, some of his challenges with raising small donor money, which means he's had to raise money the old-fashioned way, which just takes more time and costs more money to raise per dollar. And then there are existing doubts about Joe Biden. So I am reluctant to predict that Joe Biden will fade because he's been remarkably durable. And there is a market in the Democratic primary for somebody who is center left versus leftist. But, you know, could Joe Biden, could that role be filled by Pete as opposed to Joe? That's possible. But I'm reluctant to prematurely predict Joe Biden's demise. It doesn't mean I don't think he won't lose for some reason or another. I mean, he very well could lose. And you know, I don't know that it would be shocking. But in some ways, he's been, especially given his history as never having even been a front runner before when he ran for president, he's been remarkably durable.
What's your handle on Hill Republicans other than Pierre Delecto, a.k.a. Mitt Romney, and their sort of ongoing support for President Trump against the latest impeachment onslaught?
So I know that in the House, they're going to stick with him, except for a few. I mean, most of the Republicans that would have had a problem with the information that's been uncovered so far were beaten in 2018. They were from the toughest districts. But there is a lot of frustration with how the White House is handling this and the lack thereof. They would like to see more discipline, and they would like to, you know, not give the Democrats so much fuel. In the Senate, there's no desire to get on Trump's bad side. There's no desire to have a split in the party. And so with a lot of this information, most of them are going to grit their teeth and bear it. But there are some of them that are not pleased, and you will see them speak out from time to time. They're a little bit more open to seeing, you know, the breadth of all of the evidence such that it is or is not by the time the House votes to impeach, which I think it will. And I would say that the Syria policy pushed, you know, implemented by the president over the past, 10 days now, has Republicans in the Senate in particular, but in the House as well, very, very unhappy.
Yeah.
They were all willing to voice that unhappiness in the midst of all of this. You don't see that often. And if the president doesn't appreciate exactly how unhappy they are, he's really missing something. They are furious. They're dismayed. They're just beside themselves.
And the impeachment, you think, is likely to happen before year's end?
They're going to. Yeah, I mean, I get myself in the hot water when I make these predictions, which I try not to do. But I don't see how the House doesn't vote to impeach. I don't see how Democrats don't have the votes to impeach based on everything we know and based on what they've said about what we know. And he will not be removed in the Senate, but there will be a trial. Mm-hmm. And the Chief Justice, who's John Roberts, will preside. He will have basically sole discretion over motions. And so it's going to be a rule under the rules of the Senate, a trial under the rules of the Senate that will occur. I don't think you'll get, you know, more than a handful or less of Republicans to vote to remove, if you get that. But, you know, these things can cut both ways, right? It's very politically uncertain to be impeached and go through this. I can lay out a scenario where it doesn't hurt the president and maybe hurts Democrats. I can also lay out a scenario where it's to the exact opposite. He doesn't get removed, obviously, but it's very damaging. And then I can lay out a scenario where we end up right back where we started after the Russia investigation, which is everybody believes what they already believed.
Right.
And independents were like, you know, we're not that thrilled, but find me somebody else I can vote for.
But impeachment hurts the country. I mean, the markets will be in disarray, and I don't think it's worth it.
Right. And some people agree with you, but some people do. Some people look at the president and they believe that he's causing the same kind of long-term damage that you fear impeachment will, and there are just different opinions out there.
Well, and with respect to impeachment, though, this is interesting. So last week's debate, you had several of the candidates, even the most outspoken anti-Trump candidates, and you know, that's stiff competition on that side, making notes of caution with respect to being all-consumed by impeachment. And then you see just over the weekend, I think, Vox.com sends an email out about their new podcast offering, Impeachment Explained. You're not rolling out sort of a new podcast brand if you don't intend on that going for some period of time, significant period of time. And I just wonder if there's some disconnect or uncertainty between left media and some of these left candidates about how all consumed they should be with impeachment, politically speaking.
I don't think there's a disconnect. I think everybody understands that impeachment is a major story, and there's almost no way it isn't the major story until it's over with. And I think Democrats, at least Democrats who are smart, and I think, you know, some of the presidential candidates understand this, Pelosi clearly understands this, understand there's a risk of, you know, that voters are interested in all sorts of policies and issues that are kitchen table issues, which they always are. And so when you decide to step into the breach here and engage in an impeachment inquiry, you're taking a risk that voters will understand that it's important and that you're still, you know, committed to the issues that they care about. I will say, you know, for Democratic voters, I mean, one of the reasons that House Democrats went ahead with this is they have felt pressure from their own voters to do this. So there clearly is an appetite for it from some voters.
Yeah.
You know, over time, Democrats, the biggest challenge they have now is making the case so that the country doesn't think this was a big waste of time, or at least, you know, not a big majority of the country.
Right. And also their own voters in swing states. I mean, I just saw Iowa, a survey, I think it was Morning Consult last week. But anyway, it was a survey suggested, you know, impeachment among self-identified Democrats in Iowa, a swing state, doesn't even rank in the top four or five issues. So, you know, they need to be careful overreaching even within their voters in swing states.
Yeah. I mean, that's the whole ballgame, are swing voters and independents, the persuadables. They actually still matter. They still exist, no matter the focus on base politics on both sides of the aisle. And, you know, whichever way they swing in the election in the critical states, that's probably how the election goes. And they're the whole ballgame.
He is David Drucker, senior political correspondent for The Washington Examiner, WashingtonExaminer.com. David, thanks for joining us.
Anytime, guys. Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's morning answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Last week, Friday, we had Oak Park trustee Dan Maroney on.
Oh, that's right.
To talk about his colleague, the tolerant Dr. Susan Buchanan, who basically said white men need to shut up, right, in Oak Park. That went became a national story.
You're white, you have light skin, you don't know what oppression means.
They got a board meeting tonight, if I recall what Dan said, but
oh,
that should be lively. especially because we had a couple other Oak Park trustees chime in when they got word that Dan Maroney had done the unthinkable and come on our show to discuss this issue.
Really? They complained?
A trustee, Oak Park trustee named Artie Walker Petacotla, who self-described Oak Park's AOC.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
As a fellow trustee, this is vile, meaning coming on our show. This is a vile, reprehensible act by Trustee Maroney. He knows that his Brett Kavanaugh-like outrage has resulted in our board receiving death threats, yet he goes on the radio to keep this story alive. Someone's ego has been bruised.
He was reasonable and measured in his response, and he was just talking about the situation. He didn't make any
inflammatory
comments about coworkers.
Rob Braymeyer, I guess, I don't know, he's some dink in Oak Park. This is extremely irresponsible and divisive by Trustee Maroney. The violence and hatred he continues to enable is reprehensible and not in keeping with Oak Park values.
What are Oak Park values?
Let's have a discussion of Oak Park values. I mean, we know nuclear free zone. Got that. We know white men need not apply. Got that.
White men's opinion is not important. White men should really just go away.
We know men should wear only open-toed footwear. We know that's an Oak Park value. A lot of kale as sort of a staple.
Flax seed's good, too.
Yeah. We know that. What else? Oak Park values. So help me, 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I want to make sure we have an exhaustive list. I don't want to be promoting hate and so on and so forth as Oak Park's AOC and, I don't know, her sidekick here suggest. Speaking of AOC, the real one was in Queens. We talked a little bit about her with David Drucker, but I think you need to hear more from her. Listen to this this riff from AOC.
I'm in the United States Congress now. And that's a long, long way from being a sexually harassed waitress in downtown Manhattan 1 year ago.
Well, she's a victim.
Oh, is she done gone it? She's going to have her Me Too movement, right? Or moment.
She's a victim. And
oh, please. And I was a waitress for 4 years. Get over it.
Bernie rescued her from that fate of being treated boorishly by her employers, by patrons of the Taqueria. Where she was a waitress. I want to play again what she said about what the Bolshevik Bernie AOC Socialist Spice Girls revolution means. This is important.
Last February, I was working as a waitress in downtown Manhattan at a taqueria.
Taqueria.
I worked shoulder to shoulder with undocumented workers who often worked harder and hardest for the least amount of money.
True.
I was on my feet working 12-hour days with no structured breaks. I didn't have health care.
No structured breaks.
I wasn't being paid a living wage. And I didn't think that I deserved any of those things. Because that...
I hear you, sister.
Yeah.
Because that is the script that we tell working people here and all over this country. That your inherent worth and value as a human being is dependent on an income that another person decided to underpay us. But what we're here to do is to turn around that very basic logic.
Yeah, learn to turn around that basic logic. So it's just really interesting to listen to her with the victim rap, with the proletariat, workers of the world unite shtick. But think about the implications of what she's saying. You know, the living wage stuff, sexually harassed, the undocumented workers who work harder than Americans, of course, so on and so forth. All of the sophistry. they will tell you what you will pay. What they want to do is take the public sector union model to the private sector. The employees are in charge, not the employer. Structured breaks. I worked without structure breaks. What do we want? Structure breaks. When do we want it?
No.
In a timely fashion.
But anybody who's worked in the food industry or the restaurant industry knows, yeah, there's going to be times when you're slammed and you're not going to have, that's why they don't have structured breaks, Dan, because they can't structure them.
Forget the industry. Happen. The industry doesn't matter.
She got tips, okay, and she probably didn't claim them on her taxes.
This is applicable across the board. This is a ideological revolution. And even though she, at best has a room temperature IQ, and she is so thinly read, it's embarrassing with her sing-songy ignorance. She doesn't resemble at all the unfortunate evil talents of the Marxes and the Lenins of the world from a bygone era. So she's just trying to pantomime some of the lines, but that's what she's talking about. Now, Comrade Bernie, on the other hand, is the real deal. The real deal. And even if he doesn't make it to the nomination, and even if the Socialist Spice Girls are sort of relegated to a novelty act in the House, make no mistake about this. There is a problem here that needs to be confronted straight away, a discussion that needs to be forced, meaning confronted, not by the state. That's their business. Meaning you need to prompt this discussion about what kind of economic system we should have in a free society, if a society is going to be free. Richard in Blue Island, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, hey, Dan and Amy. Just wanted to make a comment about AOC's remark about not making a living wage and working hard and everything. Well, she works in the restaurant industry, and generally, when you work hard in the restaurant industry, you make money on tips. Now, generally, I tip 20% or more. I don't make it exact, but, I mean, generally, I'm tipping over 20%, you know, if they're, you know, doing their job.
Yes, right. Thanks for the call, Richard. Right.
Have you ever been in the service? Oh, you were a caddy.
Yeah.
And you survived on tips, right?
Well, I mean, a caddy growing up. Yeah. I mean,
you had your mom and dad there to help you.
It's this whole idea. Nobody, minimum wage is not meant to be a quote unquote livable wage. You're not supposed to support a family of four in a minimum wage.
No, you start out at minimum wage.
Nobody actually makes minimum wage for more than 6 months, especially in a tight labor market. It's a joke. This is all flimflammery, but it's flimflammery with a point. And the operative word that is used by AOC and her ilk is deserve. It's not human right. It's deserve. I deserve this, and I deserve that, and we deserve this, and we deserve that, and we're going to make a claim on you at the point of a gun to provide what we say we deserve. Blank checks. Look at what the Chicago Teachers Union is doing and has done historically, and the other public sector unions, SEIU, blank checks, and just apply it to your sector, your business, your work environment. That's what they aim to do. For starters, John in Villa Park.
Hey, it's your everything you're saying is exactly right, and this stuff makes me sick, but it's your education and experience that demand more pay, and it's up to you to make yourself that valuable. And we all know that everyone that says, oh, you're going to get all these things, in the end, these people are just going to get scraps. They never get nothing. And is she willing for the person that washes her car or cuts her grass where she's probably looking for the best deal? Is she going to pay them double or triple just because they deserve it? They're on their feet all day? Thanks.
Thanks, John. Jim in South Elgin.
Good morning, guys. How are you?
Hello.
I'm from Mr. South. Billy Promo Park. I was born and raised. I went to high school there. And I left there about 40 years ago in part because Oak Park was very small-minded. Just to give an example, way back when, Oak Park used to have all these stores like Marshall Fields and Litton's and Weebolts and things, just like a small addition of Michigan Avenue was. It was really cool. But then you know, like, for example, there was an old grade school near the downtown that closed, and a fellow wanted to put in a marina tower type of development there, and people say, well, the architectural skyline was too high, and so the guy made it lower and lower and lower, and finally became untenable, so he walked away. And during that time, that's when all these malls like Stratford and Oak Brook and Woodfield were being built, so all the business got sucked out of Oak Park. And so Oak Park was a dearth of business for quite a long time. And now when you go to downtown Oak Park, you see a bunch of small high-rises because they had to grow vertically to keep their population base. And also, Forest Park has seen a lot of restaurants relocate out of Oak Park into Forest Park because of Oak Park's stupid tactics in dealing with business. So you're seeing an example of this with these idiots in the board.
Thanks, Jim. Chuck and Delavan.
Yeah, I agree with Amy. She was probably taking and scamming all the tips and everything. Most people don't even know what a tip means. It means to ensure promptness. I want to know about these old park guys when you were talking about the open-toed shoes. How do the hog farmers go out and feed their pigs with open-toed shoes in old parks? Because I have to wear boots when I go out to take care of my hogs.
Yeah, I don't think so for the call, Chuck. I don't think they have any big hog farms in Oak Park anymore. But, yeah, Tim in Woodstock.
Did see a chicken coop.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, I think she uses kind of a sleight of hand in saying that a person's human value is based on what somebody thinks that they're worth. No, it isn't. It's actually based on your contribution to the economy. And I wonder what other country or government system she thinks she could go from being a waitress to being a congresswoman in 1 year, you know, instead of praising that and saying what, you know, what an amazing country, what an amazing system it is. She turns it around and leverages it for political purposes, and it's very sad.
Thanks for the call, Tim. You remind me to point out something else, too. Yeah, she's talking, when you talk about how much money somebody makes, that's their economic worth in a market. That's not their worth as a human being. Your salary is not your worth as a human being. And she purposely, well, I shouldn't say she purposely does it because she's probably too ignorant. But she is conflating the two, and the left purposely does, even if she's not purposely doing because she's not that skilled. Purposely. You are not your worth as a human being is not your job. That doesn't have to define the entirety of you. And that's not what we're talking about. Because you make less money than somebody else, you have less value as a human being. Nobody believes that. I don't. So that's the cheap sophistry of the Marxist left when it comes to economics. Byron and Lombard.
Hey, Dan and Amy. I kind of stumbling over this in my mind for days now, and I want to offer it as, you know, raising everything to a higher level is kind of like, what makes a society work? What are the things that we need so that everybody benefits from all of us being together, the contribution that all can do? South Side of Chicago is not really benefiting because we're not all working together there. When it comes to AOC, Bernie, the Democrats, where are they leading us to help us make a society better? You mentioned about the value of people. People have value all over the place without regard to salary. How do we bring all that together to make the society that we want? And like I said, I'm still stumbling, so I'm anxious to hear if you have anything at a slightly higher level.
Well, thanks for the call, Byron. I have something in rap form at a higher level.
Oh.
This is brought to you by Emergent Order. They did really good work. This is really well produced. I saw over at Reason.com. I think it was actually commissioned by the American Economic Institute for Research. Marx versus Mises. You probably heard Karl Marx's name. Maybe some of you haven't heard Ludwig von Mises. You should familiarize yourself with him, the great Austrian economist, founder of the Austrian School of Economics. They put together a little rap that gives you an outline of what a couple of different competing systems of men and women interacting in a free society with respect to their economic pursuits could look like. We'll give Marx the floor first.
Marx versus Mises. Mises versus Marx. The march of history continues.
Workers of the world, assemble. It's
time for the ruling classes to tremble. I'm the people's hero, the MVP, M-A-R-S. Yeah, you know me. Let's go back to when men were free. We hunted and gathered communally. But get ready, cause here comes the twist. A villain appears called a capitalist. He puts the proletariat,
that's us,
in chains. Exploits our labor in pockets of gains. Through slick ads he tricks lads and ladies in kind. Selling fake needs he poisons our hearts and minds. He rots our soul through alienation, pursuing limitless accumulation. He works us into an early grave. Through debt steals back the money we save. Greed is the gospel, profit. The rich get richer through graft and fraud. The poor get poorer, but you don't care. Doesn't that sound lazy, unfair? 200 years I've been singing this song. Now my chorus is 99% strong. The revolution's here, it's time to repent. Your moment is over, your capital spent.
Lazy, unfair, Mises responds.
Guten Tag, Marx, nice to meet ya. My name's Ludwig, call me teacher. The master of markets, the Austrian boss. You don't like profits? Well, let's talk loss. The problem with your plan is nobody wins except Stalin, Pol Pot, Ho Chi Minh, Lenin, Mugabe. Remember Berlin? They built a wall to keep their people in. Your theories have a rotten foundation. Built on control, not cooperation. Centralized power completely corrupts. Real people suffer, violence erupts. Your system depends on the very same people you decry as greedy, bourgeois, and evil. If we're not fit to run our own lives, why would you expect our votes to be wise? If you really want to help people rise up, unleash the free market, lift their lives up. It was capitalism, not a socialist plan. Sank billions in India, China, Japan. Everyone has a unique purpose and plan. No one solution can serve the whole land. Each individual has their own voice. The heart of my theory is freedom and choice.
Wow. Round two. Oh. Marx. Okay.
Free marketeers love to play this game. Mao kills billions, Marx gets blamed. It's deceptive, dishonest, plain unfair. Did I drive the tanks at Tiananmen Square? Man, I'm a humanist. You can check my receipts, but you gotta break eggs if you wanna eat. Don't like violence? Admit defeat. Then I'll call this revolution complete. Till then, let's get a few things straight. I'm not shaping the future, I'm embracing our fate. My utopian forebears weren't that specific, but this analysis is highly scientific. Every social system has governing laws. Capitalism? Doomed because the system generated its own fatal flaws by uniting workers in a common cause. Thanks to you, we have all the wealth we need to seize control and eradicate greed. The people are rejecting your bourgeois lies. Real Marxism has never been tried. Equality is the core of my creed. From this one's ability to that one's need. Our healthcare, finance, and industry. Let's collectivize and set ourselves free.
And Mises gets the last word.
Standard refrain, oh, that's not the real thing. The most common verse all your followers sing. The closer we get to your ideal system, further we go down the road to surfer. The empirical record can't be denied. Your ideas don't work, but they just won't die. Attention! This is not breaking news. Jevons and Menger lit that fuse. Now here comes the bomb via von Bon Bevern. He blew up your system, exposed the cork work. The heart of your theory is exploitation of surplus value. That's a bogus equation. You can't explain value by measuring the cost of labor. That theory of value is lost favor. Value is subjective by every measure. One man's trash is another man's treasure. There's no exploitation if two people arrange voluntary exchange. Man, that's not deranged. That bourgeois transaction, you diss where the scum creates benefit for both, so we're both better off. Here's the real problem, the crucial equation. Without private markets, there's no calculation to coordinate courses, allocate resources, incentivize choices, because it lacks prices. Should this factory go? Should I pick a J.O.? How would your planners ever know? Your theory is a bundle of confusion. Socialism got crushed by the marginal revolution.
It's about enough fun 9 minutes if you want to do a little tutorial on the two systems that are frankly at play, not perfectly. Because even most conservatives aren't arguing for a true free market, managed capitalism, government involvement. But it's very, very good in terms of laying out sort of the fundamentals and framing the big choices you have to make. You want to choose Marxism versus something approaching capitalism. Sarah in Lincoln Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer. Hi, Sarah.
Hey, Sarah, you're on.
Yes, hi, good morning. I just wanted to make a comment about AOC and her being confused about economic worth. Well, I'm a stay-at-home mom, so what does that say about me?
Well, ooh, that's a good question.
Well, yeah, thanks for the call, Sarah. Right, I mean, you're betraying the feminist revolution, which is part of the working class revolution. Of course, that would be the answer. And but also, too, she'll mandate for you the same thing she wants to mandate for others. That's somebody else's obligation.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.